With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem-solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
We're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one. Yes, we're the Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers. Houston Oilers number one.
Hello, everyone. You're listening to Battle Red Radio. I'm Matt Weston. This evening, I'm joined by Carlos and Jordan, as you know, as Texans Thoughts on the internet. How are you guys doing tonight?
Doing pretty good. Excited to talk to O'Brien.
Doing good. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So tonight's show is kind of a simple premise where the idea is that everything is in and of itself. So like hate and love, I guess, are the exact same thing, where without one, you can't have the other without any sort of reference point. And so you can't have courage without cowardice. And in this case, you can't have hating Bill O'Brien and saying he's a very bad, stupid football coach without at least understanding what, you know, he's good at doing. And right now, the Texans fan base is kind of split. Or I wouldn't say probably it's split, but like most of the fan base is adamant that he's a bad head coach, he's a bad general manager, he needs to go. And there's that other part of the fan base that is like really entrenched that, no, he's not that bad. He just needs more time. He finally has the chance to build the team exactly how he wants it now that he's the general manager and, you know, all those sorts of things. And so I think both sides kind of lose their argument whenever they don't admit, you know, what he's bad at, or even on the cases most people, like what he's good at. And so we kind of know what he's bad at already. You know, years, first down runs, sticking to awful quarterbacks that are either tall and wide or athletically limited and smart, the inability to work with others, Alfred Blue having 183 carry seasons, stagnated ball control offenses, constantly churning out, you know, crappy quarterbacks, being flat and preparing big games, getting bad values in trades, not utilizing a skill player as well, generally being unable to work with others at all. And also, like, nobody from his staff has graduated to excel in any other places. Like, I don't even think George Scottsy has a job. And if he does, he's probably like an offensive control assistant somewhere. But like, nobody's really kind of gone from the Texans to go have success in other spots as far as being a coach goes. And now that he's the general manager, he's been able to make absurd trades, act in a short-sighted, desperate manner, and then also get, you know, some terrible returns from the trades that he's made as well here. For the bad things, Carlos, am I missing anything here at all, or is that kind of sum it all up?
That is a fantastic cover for what's wrong with Bill O'Brien.
And then the one thing I could be maybe missing be like a lack of postseason success. You know, beating the Raiders with Matt McGloin, or I mean, not even with Matt McGloin, he was hurt that game as well. Beating the Raiders with Connor Cook, who never started another game, doesn't really signal like a lot of playoff success, and still not getting past the second round as it's always been, you know.
I think something else might be the handling of his star players. You know, I think the JD situation and just with Hop, that's definitely another thing to add on to the list.
Yeah, I like that one a lot too. Jordan, do you have any other bad Bill O'Brien qualities?
That's pretty good. I don't think there's much else to say, but I got a couple more. Just last year, rotating Chris Click, that is how it went up. But that one really grinded my gears. I just don't know the logic behind that. Also, not having a play fourth down against the Chiefs, that's pretty inexcusable. You're literally the play caller. Just general like clock and challenging flags mismanagement, that too. But yeah, you pretty much nailed it.
Yeah, the Chris Clark thing is absurd, where it's like, I don't know, I feel like he's kind of like a symbol of the Bill O'Brien era, where he just keeps popping it keeps popping up like consistently, you know, throughout the time. Like, I think he's been starting in Houston here and there since like 2015. And, you know, he never is able to fully go away. And hopefully this year with the Heck pick, and hopefully Heck doesn't play at all, but hopefully Howard stays healthy and Tunsil stays healthy. And, you know, we don't have to see any any sort of Chris Clark, see his face, he'll kind of pop up ever again here in Houston. But you never know. It's always like one twisted knee away from Chris Clark showing back up. And I'm sure he could play guard if they absolutely have to play guard as well, too. So what we're going to do for tonight's show is kind of talk about some of the good things, I guess, about Bill O'Brien. And some of this is a lot of scraping the barrel, like really trying to dig deep and do the best we can to come up with some of the stuff. So the first one I have here is that he wins football games. And so in O'Brien's career, he's 54-46. The Texans have won the AFC South 4 of his 6 seasons as a head coach. He's had a winning record every season, except for 2017 when Deshaun Watson tore his ACL, and Bill O'Brien's 2014 draft selection, Tom Savage, took over as the starter. And the Texans, of course, went 4-12 that season. I think like the people who still believe in Bill O'Brien, still like Bill O'Brien as head coach, they kind of point to the fact that, you know, the Texans aren't like a terrible football team at all ever. They consistently win games, and they kind of are able to point to the argument that, well, what other options would Houston have? Like, they could bring somebody else in who would be worse and wouldn't be able to win games and consistently win the division. And for a franchise that has been, you know, the majority of the time it's been really bad and been like a Cleveland Browns sort of franchise or a Jaguars sort of franchise, they even like winning 9 games and winning the division is a very grand achievement whenever you think about the Texans over the course of, you know, their 18-year history or whatever it is now. Carlos, so do you like this argument that Bill O'Brien just wins football games?
I mean, look, we handle a lot of, you know, variances in the strength of schedule year over year. He wins. Actually, sometimes he loses the easy ones too, but he does pull out wins when they're necessary. I mean, we've made the playoffs pretty regularly during his tenure. He's gotten us there. I just feel like, you know, whenever it comes down to performing on a big stage, it almost always goes haywire.
I guess just to keep things positive, like, it could be a lot worse. That's kind of how it is, I guess. And with coaching and with just things in general, I guess people tend to think like new is always better. And we don't know, like, for sure. Like, Bill O'Brien's a pretty awful coach, but he's not like a bottom like 5 coach. Like, there's definitely worse people out there. And so we don't know for sure. Like, say we get rid of him and we could end up with a worse coach. We don't know for sure.
Yeah, I was kind of point to, like, he gets the bare minimum out of the team and roster. And so I think, like, usually, you know, whatever the Texans record ends up with, that's usually about, like, what their talent level should at least get out of them. And maybe it's a little bit slightly less, especially since, like, Watson's been the quarterback and, you know, he's been such a great deep thrower and they're constantly throwing the ball on first down. And the offensive play calling, it kind of limits the offense in general. But I think over the course of, you know, a 6-year head coaching career, like, I do think, like, he gets the bare minimum out of his team. And there's plenty of head coaches like, you know, Freddie Kitchens or Hugh Jackson or even, I don't know, I don't dig Doug Marrone that much, but maybe that's a bad option as well, too. Like, Adam Gase, for example. Like, those are all head coaches who don't even get the bare minimum of talent on their roster and constantly see players leave and play better elsewhere. And Houston's seen that a little bit. Some of the quarterbacks were like, you know, name redacted is worse here. Brian Hoyer was slightly better elsewhere. Ryan Fitzpatrick is slightly better elsewhere. But in general, it's like teams, players don't usually leave Houston, go on and have like really great, great times in other spots, aside from like, you know, Owen Daniels winning a Super Bowl. But I do think he does get like the bare minimum and he's, you know, slightly below average. And like, yeah, whatever the uncertainty of the future could be with somebody else is something that, you know, could be an issue. Like, I do think there are other options that would be, you know, interesting. Like, I would love Eric Bieniemy here, but like, who knows what he could do in a head coaching role. And I guess like the mystery of the unknown is kind of, and the uncertainty of the unknown is kind of one of the things that maybe keeps you, you know, hanging on to a head coach longer than you should, which can kind of like similar like with the Bengals, Marvin Lewis.
Yeah, for sure. I just think, I'm with you. There's definitely a lot of good options, and I'm obviously in favor of getting rid of. But we don't know if like the grass is green. The grass isn't always green on the other side, basically. That's what my point is.
Mm-hmm. The second one I have here is that he wins close games. So usually close games are coin flip year to year. If a team goes like 8-1 in one score games, so like the Texans last year, they went 9-3 one score games. They typically regress to the mean and get closer to that 50-50 mark, and sometimes they even flip over and see like a dramatic flip in their one possession record. And you kind of see a lot too, where you have a team who goes, you know, 1-6 in one score games, and they just have like constantly dumb mistakes, and all of a sudden that one possession record flips to make the playoffs. And a really good example of that is the 2017 Chargers, who I think went like 1-8 in one score games. In the following year, they went like 5-1 in one score games. And then they're in the playoffs, and then they're getting their teeth kicked in by the Patriots in the divisional round. But it happens all the time. But in Bill O'Brien's career, he is 29-24 in one possession games, which is a little bit better than a coin flip. And there, he's also 4-1 in overtime games. And so, like, which is kind of weird too in its own sense, where, you know, O'Brien, I feel like, constantly makes bad challenges, makes bad fourth down decisions, or he's been better about fourth down, but the Chiefs game was a big example of that. Constantly mismanages the clock, like, isn't like prepared for certain plays in the red zone and all sorts of things. And even though, despite all of that, he still has a positive record in one score games. Jordan, do you kind of buy this argument that he's a good close game coach, or is this just kind of like a fluke over the course of 53 games?
It definitely helps. And I think a lot of it for me, like close games, you think about like your quarterback kind of pulling it out for you. Think about your quarterback making a clutch game winning drive. That's kind of what I think about when you talk about a one possession game. And for him, like, he has the benefit of Deshaun Watson, but also most of his career, he's went through QB purgatory. So that does kind of speak to his ability to coach and win games. And it kind of reminds me of, I think there's some random stat that like Bill O'Brien is like whatever and something and like only lost like a couple games when he's like leading after halftime. I think it's like 21 something. But that kind of reminds me of that too. So that's another thing.
Gotcha. Carlos, do you buy this argument that Bill O'Brien's a good close game coach because of this 29-24 record?
I do think that Jordan made a really good point when he talked about Bill O'Brien going through quarterback purgatory. I mean, whether that was his own making or not, but he did deal with a lot of, you know, average, mediocre, subpar quarterbacks and managed to pull out some really close dubs. So I think there is some value to the argument to say that Bill O'Brien does know how to win some close games, but his time management, some of his decision making puts us in those one possession game positions.
Yeah, it is. It is bizarre. Like, that's kind of that the record is what it is. And it's like not even just a Deshaun Watson thing. Like, even going back to, you know, 2016, like Name Redacted, he won some close games. Like, even Bram Weeden is 1-0 for Houston. He won his spot start against Tennessee, where like he did nothing but he hit a sideline throw down the right sideline to set up a field goal that won that game too. And so it's like, as weird as it's been, and like even with Deshaun Watson, without Deshaun Watson, and all the kind of like the hair pulling, you know, game management decisions he's made, like it still has kind of come out on a positive side for Houston in these one score games. The next one I have here is that he exceeds his win totals, his expected win totals. And so what I mean by that is if you look at Pythagorean record, which just says how many games the team should win based off their point differential. So like if you typically outscore your opponent over the course of a season, you tend to win more games. And it kind of goes back to the fact that if you win by 10 points, there's less chance of something bizarre happening. Like you go to take a snap to kneel the ball and you fumble it and their team gets it and they kick a field goal and they win the game. And what other weird things can happen? Those things aren't an issue whenever you're up by, you know, 14 or so. And it tends to be that really good teams beat bad teams by a lot of points, and mediocre teams tend to play a lot of close games, which has kind of been said during O'Brien's tenure, where he's played a lot of close games and has been able to win them. But if you go back to 2014, Houston was negative 0.8 for expected win totals. In 2015, he was plus 0.2. In 2016, he was plus 2.5. In 2017, he was negative 1.7. In 2019, he was plus 2.2. And in 2018, he was plus 0.8. So this comes out to 3.2 more wins than his Pythagorean record, just based on point differential. So Carlos, like, do you see this as him playing this many close games as being like the ability of like his style of play? And do you see this like doing better than expected as like his ability to, you know, make kind of like a mud fight of a game and make the game in his style, and then allow his guys to kind of use their talent to win games in the end?
I think it really does come down a lot to individual players showing out in clutch moments and pulling these wins out of the hat. I do think that over his career, you know, with the adjusted win totals and everything and the Pythagorean record, I think it does speak to his ability to keep the team in the game. But I do think that it does depend a lot on the players to stand up and really show out, you know, when it matters the most to pull out that dub and improve at least the perspective on his win totals.
Yeah, I think that's pretty interesting. I think it's one of the best stats that you found, actually, expected win totals. The fact that he beats it every time, or I guess overall, is plus 3.2. That's pretty good. I wouldn't expect that from him, honestly. And I guess it just shows that, I guess one way to look at it is maybe just like the media being down on us and like not really expecting us to win that many games based off like the previous season or however they do it. But if he's consistently coming on top like this and doing better than everyone thinks that we should do, that's got to speak to something. But I agree, it's not all about him. Obviously, he can only do so much. The players are the ones who actually go out and do it on the field. So, yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that comes out to his 2016 season when I think they won. You know, they won 2 point. When they won 2.5 more games than expected. I think their Pythagorean record was like 6.7 that year, something along those lines. And you know, 2017, the following year, you're kind of expecting that regression to happen, and it did happen with Watson, where I think Houston, whatever, he was the starting quarterback, they were like 1-3 in one score games and lost those close games to Seattle and Kansas City and New England. And you kind of saw that one possession record kind of flip in 17. And then once he got hurt and Savage is the quarterback, like the whole season was over. And Savage, I think, was even, you know, had a negative one score record in that season as well too. And so like it kind of flipped in 17, and you know, next year is gonna be really interesting for Houston, where, you know, it's Watson's fourth year and they didn't really add a whole lot to the pass defense, and they made a lot of changeups with their skill positions. And they're also a team that went 9-3 in one score games in 2019 and had a positive turnover differential, and you'd expect regression from them. And regressions from 10-6, you know, usually means a possible, like, you know, 8-8 record that can miss the playoffs. And so that's something you really keep your eyes out on for next year, is if the decisions they made this offseason will outweigh that possible flip in their one score record in 2020 as well. Oh, sorry. I was saying, I pulled up the records here for halftime stats too that you mentioned. And so I think doing this right here, the Texans have played 40 games where they had a halftime record over O'Brien's career, and they've only lost 3 of those games. So they are 37-3 whenever they're leading at halftime. And those losses were to Indy in 2017 when they were down, they're up 17-16 at halftime. They lost, They lost 13-22, and then 2018 they lost 30-32, and then 2019 against New Orleans they lost 28-30. After leading at halftime. So it's only happened 3 times where they blew a second half lead.
Yeah.
It's actually very impressive.
I wonder what the formula for that is. I guess he gets to like run the ball and kill the clock like he wants to. I don't really know.
Yeah, it's weird. I'm about to go through here and see how many of those are one score games, but it looks like close to like 15 of them or so are one score games. And the rest, they kind of like had their weird situations where they played well the entire game and blew out the opponent, which tends to happen every once in a while, you know, for this team. So the next one I have here is that Bill O'Brien has this positive winning record despite starting the following quarterbacks. Ryan Fitzpatrick went 6-6. Case Keenum went 2-0. T.J. Yates went 2-3. Brian Hoyer went 5-4. Ryan Mallett went 2-4. Tom Savage went 2-7. Brandon Weeden went 1-0. And of course, Name Redacted went 8-6. And then even AJ McCarron went 0-1 last year. And so he's won games with 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 quarterbacks that you can classify as horrendous to slightly below average. And a lot of this is his own doing, you know, by helping run a team and making decisions, you know, with Rick Smith and then even on his own regarding the quarterback position. And by kind of like sticking and having this prototype what he likes and who he likes to work with, you know, it's kind of hurt him over time. And like he won games because of it, but it's still, you know, probably his fault too. And nonetheless, I don't think most coaches could have this same positive win total despite like throwing out this this constant just like awful, horrendous quarterback play. Carlos, which one of these quarterbacks is your favorite out of this batch of 7 guys?
Okay. this is actually a pretty easy one. I was looking at it and made a quick decision. It's definitely TJ. Mainly because he is literally the Tiger King. I mean, we might as well just start calling him Joe Exotic at this point. Just the Bengal Tamer, you know? I mean, it's a small sample size, but whenever we play the Bungles, I'm willing to just, you know, sign TJ to like a week-long contract, bring him in and let him run, give Deshaun an off week. Everybody else, you know, it's just kind of a little bit of pulling teeth. Fitzpatrick had some good moments. Keenum, I mean, the hype behind Case coming in and playing and being a Houston product was huge. It was fun, but I think at the end of the day, I think TJ means more to me than any of the other guys on that list.
What was the question? Is who's the best? Or who's
favorite? Who's your favorite out of this malodorous bunch?
Ooh, that's a tough question. I don't know why. I always had a soft spot for Brian Hoyer. I don't know what it was, but he's one of my favorite, but my favorite guy's got to be Fitzmagic. He was just like, you know, one day, one game, he looks like the MVP. Fire, nothing. He looks great. And then the next day, it looks like he's throwing with a blindfold on. Like, I don't know what's wrong with him, but his highs are really high, man. And his lows are awful, but he was always fun. He's definitely fun to watch, that's for sure.
Yeah, he was fun to watch. I liked how he dove head forward all the time and like just constantly just threw his head everywhere. And we always kind of joked around that he was the, you know, homeless guy diving for the last pizza crust behind, you know, back in the dumpster and that sort of thing too. But always diving head. And he also like, he had some moves too. I think I was doing some game charm for Football Outsiders and like the year before he signed in Houston, like 2013. And I was like, you know, Fitzpatrick does have some moves charm, like he played Tennessee, St. Louis in week 13 when both teams are like 3-12 or whatever. And it was hilarious just like watching him like juke and make some plays on the move and stuff. And he was fine. I didn't get a chance to love him because I was, you know, so distraught that they didn't take a quarterback in 14 that could actually like come in and start and compete. And they were just like, yeah, we're going to go with Fitzpatrick and we're okay with that. And I still can't believe it. Can't believe that aspect of it to its day. I think my favorite may be Ryan Mallett just because his arm strength was absolutely ridiculous. Oh. And he was also so fussy and he was so petulant.
Oh, yeah.
And he was just so tall and, you know, stupid. And but like something like, and like watching him throw the ball 140 miles per hour at like on a drag route that was 3 yards away was just some like the highest comedy in Texans history.
It was like they put Lurch at quarterback.
So, Jordan, I was looking up some of these numbers again here. So, for the halftime leads, 18 of the 32 wins were in one-score games. And then whenever the Texans don't have a lead at halftime, they're 15-41. And so it's kind of like they're like a dog race where the first dog out of the gate wins. But for the Texans, it's like, well, if they're winning at halftime, they're probably going to win. And they're losing at halftime, they're probably going to lose. And so it really is kind of like the bizarre, the splits that are here for Houston whenever they're leading or not leading at halftime. And this is just a lead of one, for example. Like, we're not talking about like a lead of seven or being down three or anything. We're just talking about 1 point making that much of a substantial difference at halftime.
Sorry, what was the change in records?
So they were 32-3, I believe, in one score games. 18 of their 32 wins were when they had a lead at halftime, I believe they were 32-3, but 18 of their 32 wins were one score games. And then when they didn't have a lead at halftime, they're 15-41.
At halftime, how that changes if they're up or down, but hopefully we can come out hot this year and just take the lead and never look back.
Yeah. So they're 37-3 when they have a lead at halftime, and they're 15-41 when they're trailing at halftime. The next one I have here is that at times the Houston Texans can have some really great offensive game plans. And so like in 2017, he did a really good job simplifying the offense and using ghost motions and jet sweeps to create a vertical passing game with Watson and creating like some really simple downfield throws that he could have success with. When Watson was a starter that year, his rookie year, they averaged 34.6 points a game. Last season, the Texans had like one really great vertical game against Atlanta. I really like the tight end repass options against teams with bad linebackers like Kansas City, like Jackson, like Oakland. I really didn't like when they play against teams with good linebacker play like the Baltimore Ravens, where it didn't work at all whatsoever. You just have Watson in the flat with nothing to do with the football. Also, I think before Watson, even too, like from, you know, 14 to 16, I think he did a fine job, like, muddying the game up and turning into a rock fight where, you know, his defense could consistently win games for him to the tune of, like, you know, 20 to 16. And the football, you know, games were boring and, you know, kind of like terrible and stupid at times, but they were able to consistently win because of the defense that they had. And, you know, they wasted a really good defense and their ceiling was limited because of the quarterback decisions in the offense. But the offensive game plan didn't match the style of the team at the time. So, like, Carlos, do you like Bill O'Brien's game plan sometimes? And also, like, why do you think he's only, like, consistently able to generate them every once in a while instead of always being able to just have a really good, sound, you know, kind of playbook entering each week, week in and week out?
You know, I think there are times where the offense seems to come alive. I mean, everybody talks about the Will Fuller split on and off, you know, when he's on, when he's around. I think that when he's forced to break out of his original game plan, he can get creative and it can open up the offense. And we see it kind of in these comebacks that they have every once in a while. When they throw out the game plan, they kind of start to spark and let Sean do his thing. It helps generate a lot of momentum for the offense. So I think the reason why it can happen week to week is because he gets, you know, he sees this wild success, maybe one game or tight comeback win, then he goes right back to the old drawing board and does the same game plan, you know, or a very similar game plan for the next opponent next week, and he sticks to his core philosophy instead of taking what seems to work and incorporating it into his weekly game plans.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I think, too, it's kind of like, I think, like, I've been watching a bunch of these coaching clinic videos to try to, you better understand team scheme and what coaches are looking for and how they kind of develop their offenses. And, like, even going to, like, Nick Saban and all these coaches, they talk about how important it is to stop the run or be able to run the football. And then you look at all the analytics and everything says the exact opposite, that you run the football really doesn't matter at all. The only time you should run the football is if you have six or less defenders in the box. And if you have anything more than that, you should throw the football. And I think, like, more coaches are starting to understand it, like Andy Reid in Kansas City, that, you know, throwing the football is really good and you should do it more often. And so I think a lot of it too is just kind of like archaic and coming up as a head coach in the 90s and still kind of sticking to that same philosophy that he was taught over and over again. And maybe this year is kind of the year that changes where he understands that, you know, vertical passing offense would be the best way to be like the that should be the core competency of an offense to Deshaun Watson, especially an offense with, you know, Brandon Cooks and Will Fuller and Kenny Stills. Do you have any anything to add about these weird, kind of like bizarre, really great offensive game plans from Bill O'Brien, Jordan?
Yeah. So our team, our offense in particular, is very volatile. Like we've been mentioning the Will Fuller splits, but also it just kind of seems like it's almost like he picks and chooses just randomly, just by like rolling a dice of when he wants to call a good game or not. Like there's obvious ones where the Patriots last year, he called a great game. I'll give him that. And that was probably one of the ones where he's like, okay, I got to get back a Bill and I got to win one game finally. But other than that, like you look at the random games, like the Falcons, like, I don't know, that was just like a completely random game, like that we just kind of just took off and just really used the vertical passing game, really attacked our linebackers too. So I don't know what his method to his madness is at all. I think he's a very tough person to figure out, but I hope he sticks to it. Like you've been saying, we've got the weapons for it. The offense is tailored to it. And it's tailored to Deshaun's strengths, bringing in all these speed, wide receivers. That's what he's really good. He's really good at throwing the deep ball. He was probably, I think he was the first or the second most accurate quarterback last year. So we're playing strengths and it's gross.
Yeah, and I mean, it's even weird kind of last year too, where they had games like against the Jaguars, for example, in London, where he threw, I think, zero passes or 15 yards that game, you know? And it's like, yeah, this works against the Jaguars, but what are you going to do whenever you play Baltimore, Kansas City, where you need to score 31 points or you can be prepared to be able to do something like that? And I do feel like O'Brien at times, I mean, a lot of times he's just trying to get the bare minimum done to be able to win games instead of using the regular season as the chance for your reps and try out different things that can work in your games where they really matter. So, like even that Atlanta game too, I think one of the things that really screwed Atlanta was, you know, one, their cornerback play was bad. Two, their pass defense is bad, especially their rush. Like, it's just Vic Beasley running around the quarterback and the occasional Grady Jarrett pressure. But also they lost Rekar Neal too the week before, and they really had no communication on their secondary in the back end. And yeah, he's kind of like their leader at the free safety position. And they were constantly able to put pressure on the middle of field safety and force in one direction, use those same like deep crossers over and over again that, you know, worked against Atlanta but didn't work as well when they played Baltimore a few weeks later, that sort of thing. So I don't know. It is volatile, and I wonder how much of it in the past few years has to do with just Will Fuller, you know, constantly being in and out of the lineup too. The next reason I have here is that he hired Romeo Crennel to be the team's defensive coordinator. And so from 2014 to 2019, the Texans defense ranked 7th, 7th, 11th in points allowed. Then the one Mike Vrabel season, this dropped to 32nd, and they went back up to 4th and then 19th in points allowed. Then in DVOA, they ranked 6th, 8th, 9th, and then 23rd in Mike Vrabel season. And then last year, they ended up ranking 26th in defensive DVOA. And so, like, I do think his hands-off approach on the defense and hiring Crennel and sticking with him was really valuable. I think Crennel did a great job here throughout his entire career. I know last year, you know, things dropped off some, and there were some weird things like, you know, the amount off man he played and not giving Jacob Martin as many snaps as he should. And something like the pass rushing, like situation lineups that he used, like, I don't know why Angelo Blackson was ever on the field on a third down at all. But overall, like, he just didn't have the horses, you know, and, you know, playing press man with Jonathan Joseph on 3rd and 7 is just a death sentence and those sorts of things. And so I think it was more of a talent issue than a scheme issue with Crennel. But regardless of last season, over the last, you know, 6 seasons with Bill O'Brien's head coach, you know, Crennel was a really great defensive coordinator. He did a really good job. And, you know, his defense carried this team for, you know, the better part of 4 seasons there for Houston as well, too. So, Jordan, what did you think about Crennel during his time here? And do you think that was one of the best decisions that Bill O'Brien made?
Yeah, I think you're completely right with the whole hands-off approach kind of thing. I wish that's what he would do with the offense. I wish he would bring in a different voice, different opinion, and kind of take over that. But he was able to do it with the defense. Crennel has been a very well and high regard. And you're right, he's done really good with us. His kind of like bend but don't break kind of style, he's constantly has in quarters coverage, kind of taking away the deep ball. That's really the main thing that I think was great about him. And you saw effective when we had the pass rushers to go after quarterbacks and just be able to rush forward, because Crennel doesn't really like the blitz, so he just rushes forward a lot. And if we have like a healthy JJ Watt, if we have Merciless in his prime and Clowney, like those were the years where our D-line was scary and our defense was nasty. And like you said, like, we didn't really have the horses for it last year. We need some more talent. So it wasn't entirely fair to put all the blame on him, but he's definitely been a great hire by Bill O'Brien.
I think he's been a super solid addition. I think him jumping in is completely save the last couple seasons. I mean, outliers last season, obviously, but for the most part, I think he's done a very good job. He's probably one of the best coordinators we've ever had. And, you know, like Jordan said, Bill O'Brien should have just left everything alone, you know, have the coordinators run everything. I mean, really, with Cal and his vote of confidence in him, he really could just be king of the castle at this point. So just let somebody else do the work. And Rack's done an extremely good job. I just think he's getting a little up there. Who knows how much longer he's going to want to coach for. So hopefully Weaver's got stuff to help out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think Crennel's like in his early 70s right now, too. And the other interesting thing about this defense was, like, you know, Jordan mentioned about rushing your front four. Like, the Texans pass defense throughout Crennel's career has been like, it's been entirely dependent on the pass rush, where when the pass rush is great, they are like a top three defense. When it isn't, they're like a bottom six defense or so. And it's a team that's really dependent on the pass rush. And that was one of the reasons of many that, like, I absolutely hated the Clowney trade, was just how important a pass rush is for Houston and how much of a reliance it is. And then if, you know, something happened to Watt, like happened last year, you know, their pass rusher would crater without somebody like Clowney who can step in and, you know, kind of carry a pass rush on his own. And, like, yeah, he doesn't have the sack numbers, but he has the pressures and the quarterback hits. And it was by far like the most productive rusher that even Seattle had last year too. The other thing about Crennel, like, entering this year or last year too, is he was like top 10 in blitz rate, which is kind of weird for a Crennel team where they typically don't blitz all that much, but he blitzed a lot more last season. He tried just about everything, but, like, nothing really worked at all. It was just constantly just like I felt so bad kind of watching some of the tape where it just looks like they're playing patty cake along the defensive line. He has six guys blitzing and nobody's able to even make the quarterback uncomfortable. And I'm sure it was very frustrating for him to try to like figure out how to do anything at all behind that. And that was, you know, one of the big reasons why Houston finished 26th in defensive DVOA last year.
Yeah, I think that's a big thing. I think scheming up pressure, I guess, so I didn't know that he was top 10 in blitz rate, but one thing that I always like, I've been watching for recently when I've been going over the defense is like us using stunts. And we'll use stunts a lot on third down. Like when it's third and long, we'll usually rush for and we'll do stunts like tight end tackle stunts. Or is that what they're called? Yeah. Anyways, but we're just like really bad at running those. Like I don't know if that's a coaching thing or what, but like our guys just don't seem to get like, the fundamentals of that down. So maybe Weaver's better at doing that. Maybe he can scheme them up, because that's an easy way, like even if you don't have to blitz, like just running stunts, like that confuses our offensive line all the time. Like I don't know why we can't do that to other people.
And it's really just kind of like creating interior pressure, or like creating pressure, like the first guy needs to draw two blocks, you know, and that first guy's not doing that, and then or the second guy needs to come tight off that block as well too. And so sometimes you see the first guy draw two blockers, but the second guy doesn't come tight around that block and he goes wide and looping, and the center is able to step in and pick him up too. And that blitz rate number I brought up, that's just from Pro Football Reference. They have like an advanced stats page and they get their charting data from, you know, who knows where. Maybe they get it imported from China or something. But they have Houston as the top 10 blitz rate. And whenever Football Outsiders comes out the almanac in, you know, late July, early August, that kind of talks about, well, this is four blitzers, three rushers, four rushers, five rushers, six or more. And so you have a much better idea of how many rushers they're consistently bringing. But for now, that's kind of the best I can do. The last thing I have here is he holds others accountable. I wouldn't say he holds himself accountable, but he holds others accountable consistently. Previous offensive coordinator, George Godsey, got fired and lost play calling duties. Previous special teams coach Larry Izzo got fired, and once he was fired, the special teams really took off in, I believe it was 2017, and also they've made a really big like push to making sure they have guys who only play special teams. And what's been something that's been like a constant Achilles heel for the Texans has now been just solidifies one of the strengths of the team too. The accountability thing's kind of weird because like James Devlin or Mike Devlin's still there coaching the offensive line, you know, even as all the problems that they've had, even developing some of their younger offensive linemen. But I think overall, whenever it comes to a staff, I do think if there's an issue or like a guy's not doing a good job or players are suffering or, you know, the play calling's bad, he disagrees with it, he's had a quick switch where he'll pull somebody and make a decision quickly. And you can kind of see the same thing whenever he made that hilarious decision to start Tom Savage week one and pulled him after the first half and, you know, went with Watson immediately. But I do think, like, for others, he does hold them fairly accountable, and that's one of the strengths that he has as a head coach. Carlos, do you agree with that?
Yeah, I do. I think he's got a really quick trigger on swapping people in and out if they're, you know, not performing up to par or in his eyes. I do think that he does really believe in the decisions that he makes, and he's very confident in pretty much everything that he does. I mean, whether we feel one way or another about it. He sticks to his gun, so I definitely agree.
Yeah, and for me, I really like that you brought up the special teams point. I remember literally being had to punt or kick off, and just knowing that someone was going to break a big return. It might not be a first touchdown, but like they would always get past like that 20 or 25 yard mark, and they'd always get extra yardage off that, and it was so annoying. And I literally remember being more nervous about giving up yards on kick and punt returns than like actually on defense, because like those years when we had a really good defense, we would literally be getting three and outs every time, but then when we had to punt them back, that's where they got most of their yardage and they got good field position. That's the only way that they ever scored on us, and it was just so frustrating. So I'm definitely glad he brought in, what is it, Brad Seeley?
Mm-hmm.
And mostly, I guess he's gone now, but they brought in a bunch of guys and they brought more in this year, so I'm glad they're putting an emphasis on that, because last year was amazing. Last year was like locked down, so I hope they can repeat that for sure.
Yeah, the one play that always comes to mind with the awful special teams and the Houston Texans era, well, I guess there's two plays. One is that kickoff touchdown return they give up to New England in the 2016 divisional round. And the other one, I think it's from the same year when they got like absolutely spanked by Minnesota, but they put Jay Prosh as the gunner on a punt. to like try to run some like twist and punt the ball to the right side, or like punch the ball towards him so you make a tackle, and they punted it to the other hash mark, and he was like 7 or 8 yards away from the punt returner. And I can't remember Minnesota's score, but they brought the ball into the red zone after that. And it was one of the most hilariously dumb things I've ever seen on a football field. But you know, I think the one special teams thing, I'm really glad Shane Leckler finally got old enough where they could be like, yeah, we can finally move on after years of having a bad punt unit, which he was part of too. So those are all the reasons I have for why Bill O'Brien is a good head coach. Carlos, let's hear your two reasons that you got for why Bill O'Brien's a good head coach.
Sure. So the first one I had is definitely that he's taken ownership of this team. I mean, it is his job at the end of the day. However, it seems like he's really, really beholden to his vision. And he's spent the last couple of years constructing everything in this grand scheme that he's trying to stick to. And he wants to do it here. So he's done everything in his power to make sure that there's nothing standing in his way of making, or at least forming, the team to how he sees it operating going forward. And he's consolidated power, and he's done all the things necessary where, you know, a lot of teams, they just run through head coach after head coach after head coach. And like we said earlier, you know, seeing some sort of standard set with BOB, it's better than going out and venturing to the unknown and dealing with, you know, one fluke after another and all these guys just failing out constantly, you know, like Cleveland. You know, we just have something solid. And then the second point was going to be about the, you know, how he lets defense coordinators do whatever they want on defense side of the ball. Like, they let them take accountability for it. But we've already kind of expunged on that a little bit.
Yeah, I like that point, that first point. If, you know, O'Brien was a better head coach and general manager, where it's like, if he's going to be the central figure, kind of like a college program where he runs everything, it all flows for him. And I think that model works whenever you have a guy like Bill Belichick, who, one, understands value really well, and two, is one of the greatest defensive coaches of all time. And so whenever you have that sort of setup, it tends to work pretty well. And then also, like, I feel like he does a really good job delegating and having guys he really trusts and in the roles from there, from everything from like personnel, the guy who manages personnel to his head scouts and everything else. Like, it seems like their entire organizational structure really makes sense for them on their end. But whenever it's Houston and it's somebody who, you know, the best, who's like consistently like slightly above 500 and get knocked out of the second round of the playoffs, it makes that sort of model a little bit harder to enjoy, because you kind of lose some sort of ideas, and everything is kind of trapped in the same like Houston bubble of, you know, tough, smart, and dependable, and being a Pisces, you know. So Jordan, what do you think about Bill O'Brien? Like, it's his job and he owns it, and he's able to build a culture entirely in his image.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. I like the idea of, like, technically it should work, and the idea of it, like you said, like if he was better at doing it, like, it would be great. And having a full, like, one vision that everyone can get behind. It's important in the business to have, like, a culture and a vision that everyone is on the same page with. Like, if you have dysfunction within your organization, it's not going to work. Like, everything starts from the top, right? So I like the execution. That's another thing, but we're not talking about that today. So yeah, that's where I'll end, because I feel like you guys pretty much summed it up very well.
So what's the head coaching reason that you have for Bill O'Brien?
Yeah, so I could only really think of one other one that you guys haven't mentioned so far. And for me, it's basically that he's never really lost the locker room. And you could say that about a lot of other coaches, that they have lost the locker room. You hear players, am I still there? Yeah, okay. Players like speaking out badly about them. Like, you've never really heard a player who's currently on the team, like, you've heard people afterwards or whatever, but you never really heard someone like come out and really trash talk him too much. So there's that. And there's also the fact that, like I said, he hasn't really like lost the locker room. Where the point with, like, even like the blowout games, like last year against the Broncos, the Ravens, like, I went back and rewatched them, and it was painful to rewatch, but the players were still like playing pretty hard. Like, no one gave up, no one was just like not putting in effort. Like, so there's that. That's like a pretty decent thing, I guess you could say about him. He's never really lost locker room, yeah.
Yeah, and I think a good example of that too is whenever Houston started 0-3 in 2018. I remembered it being 0-4, but I forgot they beat the Colts in overtime to stave off 0-4. But they start 0-3, and they won 9 games in a row and end up going 11-5 that year, winning the division, then losing to the first in the playoffs to the Colts. But I think that was really a situation where the whole thing could have cratered and the Texans could have gone, you know, 4-12 and had an awful season despite everything, all the talent they had in that locker room, and you know, Walt and Clowney finally being held to the same team, and they're able to prevent that from happening and you know, still make the postseason, have an awful first round loss at home to Indy, but you know, go from 0-3 and make the playoffs. I think they were only one of 4 teams to ever do that. And I think that's also another good example of him like maintaining the locker room and making sure players like to play for him.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I feel like players, they like to play, most of them at least, like to play for him. They won't say anything really bad about him as a coach. They like that aspect of him. I feel like they don't really respect him much as a GM, especially with this last offseason. But as a coach, I feel like majority of the players are in favor of him.
So we're going to move on now to him being a general manager. So I know, Carlos, you have one, and Jordan, you have 2 plus general manager one. So Carlos, what's your good general manager Bill O'Brien detail you have there?
Well, mine is that it seems that he really enjoys picking up, the pick that nobody sees coming, right? Everybody kind of has this list, especially around draft time, of optimal draft picks for, you know, whichever round. And he just seems to go against it pretty regularly. He gets players that fit his scheme really well. Greenard was a really solid pickup this year, I think, from big school that a lot of people recognize. But going, getting Charlie Heck in the 4th, trading up, making these surprise decisions, I mean, it seems like he has an idea of what he really wants and he knows when to go get it. I mean, he does have a history of getting fleeced, but whenever he does decide to move up, it seems that he's definitely got his heart set on some really specific guys that fits what he wants to do.
Yeah. A way to put it is that he's very aggressive. And once he knows what he wants to do, like you said, he'll do it. And that was a big, like, it was a big breath of fresh air for me, going from Brian Gain, who was just extremely passive and never really wanted to make a big move and wasn't looking to pay anyone, didn't want to pay Tyrann Mathieu, all that stuff. Like, going from that kind of passive plan as a GM to Bill O'Brien, just going out, trading everyone, trading picks, trading whatever to get the team that he wants, I think that was really good. It's my favorite quality of him as a GM.
What were your 2 pro Bill O'Brien general manager details, Jordan?
Yeah, so for me, I guess it kind of goes along that same length of being aggressive and making trades and stuff. For me, as much as I hate the trade, and I still hate it, and I will always hate it, and I will never agree with it, you could look at it and say that we kind of won the Jadeveon Clowney trade. I mean, in terms of getting value, getting Gerrion Conley, who I'm actually super high on after I went back and reviewed a season, I think he can be cornerback 1 for sure. Getting Conley, and then, of course, getting the man, the myth, the legend. Getting both of those guys for Clowney, that's actually a really good value, seeing as Seattle didn't even get all the games for Seattle, and then that's it. He's not re-signing, right? So they're not going to – I don't think they're going to even be able to get a comp pick out of that. Which everyone was like, oh, at the very least, you should be able to get a 3rd-round pick out of him. So he turned that value into pretty good. Not being signed, he's still kind of overvaluing himself, and that's unfortunate. I love him to death, but yeah, you can honestly say that we won that trade.
Yeah, I think that trade's kind of weird where, and it kind of feels like neither team won that trade. I mean, I don't think Seattle makes the postseason, and like they definitely don't beat they definitely don't win their first postseason game against Philly unless Clowney, like Clowney won that game just by hitting Carson Wentz in the head as he was sliding, you know, in a weird way. And so maybe they don't win that game if he doesn't do that. And so like in a sense, like trading a 3rd-round pick and Martin or whatever is fine for the chance to be able to play the Packers. And like he dominated the first half of that Packers game and then they just stopped running the ball towards him and they started running the ball whenever he came off the field and were able to be more of a balanced passing attack. And Devonte Adams did some squirrely stuff to beat their cover three to, you know, get guys turning and running and getting their blind spot and take off as well. But yeah, it's weird because it's like Seattle, you gave up very little for, you know, 1 year rental of him, and with their salary cap issues by paying your Russell Wilson $31.5 million this year, it's hard for them to pay that much for an edge defender who doesn't sack the quarterback at all. And they have like a lot of bodies in their defensive line, some depth too. And I think the bigger problem with Clowney was he just completely misjudged his own market, and he wanted $20 million, only five players get that. And he should probably be looking for like, you know, 16 or whatever. And it'll be interesting to see where he signs. But I do think Houston's defense was worse last year. And whenever you're in a situation where you have a quarterback on a rookie contract, like that's the cheat code to have a great team. Like that's the easiest path to building a great team, is having a great young quarterback who you only have to pay, you know, $2 million a year, who you're going to have to pay $30 million a year soon. And so that you can build an entire complete roster by doing so. I think Houston, by trading Clowney, really hurt their season last year. One, because they didn't have the pressure to get to the quarterback, which their pass defense depended on. And two, like they weren't able to fully take advantage of this like window they had with Watson. And they made their own team worse off by making that trade as well, too. So, I mean, it's weird. Like, I think Seattle still won the trade because they got Clowney for very little. But it didn't work out. Like, the trade was a disaster. And it didn't work out as bad for Houston as I envisioned it. And I think, like, even thinking about the Hopkins trade, too. Like, I think the Hopkins trade's going to make Houston worse off than the Clowney trade did. But it's not going to be a disaster, I don't think. Like, they still have Watson. They still have, like, competent, skilled players around him. The trade was bad, and like what their return they got was bad. Some of the Clowney trade too, but I don't think it's gonna be a disaster. And I think better play calling is gonna make it seem like the Texans were. If they do have better play calling, it'll make it seem like the Texans improved by getting rid of Hopkins. But I don't see that being the case. Carlos, what do you think? Do you think the Texans won the Clowney trade?
I think considering what we got in return, I don't know if we won, because I would have loved JD to be on that defense last year. I think he would have helped. He's an impact player, not really stats production wise, but you feel him on the field. He leaves a mark on the field whenever he's in. So I think it actually kind of balances out evenly. We did get two players, and we got Conley, and we got J-Mart, you know, the GOAT. We got him. So really, that's enough to win it right there. But I think, in terms of what we got in return, we got two, or at least Conley was a great value player for us last season. And Martin, he's a great prospect. He's a very interesting prospect, to say the least. You know, see what he shakes out on the team. But for JD to walk and go test free agency, I think you're right. He did overvalue his market. I think he is more in that 16, you know, $15 million range, I think, is a pretty fair number. So I think it kind of evens out. I don't know if anybody really won in a giant regard, but it seems pretty fair to me. I'm not mad with the trade anymore, at least.
Yeah, and it's weird, too, where, like, every single trade that gets made, somebody has to win, but both teams can win the trade, or, you know, both teams can kind of suffer from it. And I don't know. It's one of the weirdest trades that's kind of happened. What's your last one you have there, Jordan?
Yeah, actually, just before I go over that one, I kind of want to talk about the DeAndre Hopkins trade. I've got a question for you guys. I think, would it look better for you? So I think a big thing of the blowback between Hopkins, it happened, and then there was like it seemed like there was no vision in place, no plan, but then later was, then we made the Brandon Cooks trade, and people were like, oh, okay, I kind of see it. We're moving to that more speed, maybe circle back. And so that kind of maybe calmed people down. Like, people are still upset about the trade, but kind of calmed people down. So I got a question, is if it was kind of like a three-team trade where we got David Johnson, we got the 57th pick or whatever it was for Hopkins, and then like right away traded that 57th pick for Brandon Cooks, do you think if that was all like one big three-team trade where it's all announced at once, do you think that would have like made the trade hurt a lot less, and people, like, it wouldn't have had so much blowback?
I don't think so, mainly because I'd still rather have Hopkins than Blacklock at 40, Cooks, and David Johnson. And, like, I don't think the trade's going to be a disaster at all, but I think Hopkins as being, like, a top-three receiver, Like, he's not going to be replaced by, you know, Cooks and Johnson. And, like, I don't think Johnson's going to be very good all next year. I think he's going to have a lot of games where he has 20 carries for, you know, 70 yards, and he catches some passes in the flat or whatever. But, like, Duke Johnson's an even better receiver than David Johnson is, and David Johnson hasn't had a really good season since, you know, 2016. That's the only really good season he's had in his career. And also, they had to pay a lot of money for him as well, too, this year, which doesn't make any sense for a running back, too. And, like, at least get Kenyon Drake. Like, Kenyon Drake would have been a much better player to pick up than David Johnson, but Houston's been enamored with him. And, like, I really like Cooks and the skill set he brings, but the concussions are a really big concern. And I think, like, a lot of the cute things he does, like, you know, screens and jet sweeps and stuff, I don't even want to see him run those at all, just because of the concussions where he's one bad hit from, you know, taking something like that. Like, even if he runs a deep dig against, you know, across the zones and quarters or whatever that he's good at doing, like, that could take a big hit too. Or if they do any sort of trap where the corner, you know, sits and the linebacker cuts it off and ears hold him, like, that could be, you know, hit for him too with the number of concussions he had. But, like, even if it was set up like that, I still wouldn't think it's a good trade, just because I still don't like the return. And the other thing I really don't like about the trade that kind of really irks me to the O'Brien thing was making this idea that it was about money. Like, Houston couldn't afford Hopkins, which was completely true, was completely untrue, wasn't correct at all. Was like a pretty much like a straight out lie as a way to kind of sugarcoat that it was more of a trade to have to do with and a disagreement with, you know, like, culture and the fact that those two guys, you know, he just was never able to get along with Hopkins for, you know, whatever reasons. They had a, you know, like a poor, like, coach to player relationship, and it does seem like that was a trade made more so than they feel like, you know, this offense can take off without him, or this offense is gonna be better without him, or, you know, David Johnson, Brandon Cooks is better than having, you know, DeAndre Hopkins as well too. And so that's the other thing I don't like about it. Like, I think the Texans' talent is worse off without him, but I do think if they actually change their play calling, it will mitigate that, and the offense could be better next year. But I think it has more to say about how bad the play calling was in 2019, 2018 than it has to do with Hopkins switching out being, you know, a really great decision. What do you think, Carlos?
I think if it were turned into a three-team trade, right, we take everything and we put it all in one grand event, I think it helps the optics of the trade for the public to kind of be like, okay, you know, we kind of see where Bill's trying to go here. We see, you know, kind of a little bit of the plan. By separating it, I think it leaves the initial sting of like, oh my God, we got rid of DeAndre Hopkins. Then the second trade later on, like, okay, so this is what we ended up doing with that, you know, hole. I think putting it together would have made it a little bit more digestible for people. But I do think that there isn't really replacing D-Hop and what he brought to the table. But if Bill is willing to change the offense and stop trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, because it seemed like that's what was happening last year and why D-Hop's numbers were down. He is a top three receiver in the league, period. Just in what he brings to the table, his skill set, it's just the offensive play calling that results in the lower production. So hopefully he goes to Arizona, he lights it up, you know, he gets back to being regarded as one of the top receivers in the game, and Houston ends up changing their offense, and we end up relying on that speed, stretching the field, and we start putting up crazy numbers. I mean, I just think it definitely was a matter of disagreement between B.O.B. and DeAndre that led to him being shipped out. It's unfortunate, but maybe now Bill O'Brien's kind of forced his hand to come up with a cohesive offensive identity with this team.
Yeah, I think I like your point about him basically lying to the media and saying what the reason for the trade of Nuke was. I think that's what pissed me off a lot too. Just come out and be honest about it, like, that you guys had like a bad relationship or whatever. Like, everyone could tell at that point, like, it's not about the money when you go ahead and pay Randall Cobb like $10 million a year, Eric Murray however much it was, $8 million a year, and then take on the same amount of money in salary with David Johnson than you were sending out with Hopkins. So, like, clearly that just wasn't. No, Bill O'Brien, he's never like been a fan of the media, and I guess he gets that from Belichick. So maybe he just doesn't even really take the media seriously when he's trying to answer things. And I don't know. That's all I really got.
Yeah. What's your second one for O'Brien being a good general manager?
My last one was actually just kind of like the being aggressive thing that I talked about and Carlos was talking about. So Yeah, I like that he never like, and I guess, and we saw it last year where even when we're this late in the off season, like he's still gonna make changes, still gonna make big changes. Like the Tunsil trade happened like so last minute before the season started. So like, we don't know, like this, the team that we're sitting with right now, it could change a lot even before the season starts. So I just like his aggressive nature that he's not gonna sit on his hands. He's gonna make changes if he sees fit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's kind of, I guess, the issue with having a head coach as a general manager, where you have a head coach who is more likely to get fired, and his entire goal is to win games that year, and who knows how long his leash is for, you know, being a coach or whatever. And so, like, if he's on the hot seat, then he'll be more brash to make immediate, like, current decisions that will, you know, affect the team moving forward in the future. And so, like, it's good to have that aggressiveness whenever you have, like, a situation where you have, like, a really, like, a head coach who's going to be there for a long time, where there's no sort of hot seat or turmoil at all, when they consistently have, like, deep playoff runs. And that sort of aggressiveness makes sense. Like, I think Baltimore's a really good example of a team who is, like, smart with how they're aggressive, where they're not really brash with it. And I think you kind of see this in the basketball a lot, too, where you see guys get traded for, you know, spots to win for this year, and they take on weird salaries and stuff because it helps them this year. And then the next year, it's an immediate disaster, too. So it had, that aggressiveness thing does have its perks and its downsides. And, you know, regardless of that, though, like, if Bill O'Brien wants to see something happen, like, he goes out and makes it happen. No matter how many times the Dolphins tell him no, he can keep adding picks to get Laremy Tunsil.
Yeah, I think you're right. And with the timing thing, like we mentioned before, having Deshaun Watson on his, I guess this is his last year of his rookie contract, mm-hmm. now, they just picked up his option. So I guess that was the time, if he was going to go all in, I guess that's what his way of round picks and a second for Tunsil and all those other moves that they made, throwing away third rounders for Duke Johnson. But yeah, so I guess the thing with me is I can, like, I hate Bill O'Brien and I can criticize him and I can do that all day. But eventually I guess I get tired of it. Like, I don't want to have to keep complaining, keep being negative about it. And I can see kind of the plan that he's forming. I won't always agree with it, but I can see where he's coming from.
Yeah, I can see the plan, like the roster here, if they do something in offense they've never done before. And that's kind of the one thing holding me back. And, like, yeah, they have a new offensive coordinator, but the only person Tim Kelly's ever coached for is for pretty much Bill O'Brien, you know? Like, he's not some outside influence who I think is going to bring, you know, some big whole new world of ideas at all. He's just going to be an extension, a tentacle off of Bill O'Brien, you know? And so I don't, like, until I see it happen, until I see, like, you know, Cooks and Fuller and David Johnson and Kenny Stills running four verts on first and 10 with the ball like their own 25-yard line. Like, I'm not gonna really believe until that happens, you know. And whenever it does, then I'll have more faith and idea what this plan is. Because, like, again, I can see on paper and see what they're looking to do, even if I don't think it's great. I think there's like a lot of injury and a lot of like potential for it to go really badly. But again, like, if the play calling is better for, you know, football in 2020 and what the way it works now, I do think, like, regardless of the decisions that he made, the offense will be much better too. But yeah, I mean, I agree with you as well, Jordan, on the fact that, like, even if you dislike Bill O'Brien after a while, it's like, yeah, like, he's not going anywhere, you know? And
yeah,
you
exactly.
Only get 16 of these games, and you want to enjoy the games, enjoy the season. And whenever you're constantly looking as like, yeah, this is dumb, this is stupid, then you lose a lot of the enjoyment with it. And, like, I know I wasn't personally able to really savor DeAndre Hopkins' time in Houston because I was constantly like, well, he's in the slot and he's catching 7 passes for 63 yards and this is stupid. And 7 Jordan, like, that little quirk or whatever and that sort of thing. So, or being like, yeah, he's incredible, but, you know, he has Brian Hoyer throwing the football. What's the point at all anyways? And what's the point of anything at all, you know? And and so now I know, like, I'm kind of like, yeah, whatever happens with it. And I've taken my view of sports has kind of turned to just like, it's more about being entertaining than necessarily it is about winning and losing, that sort of thing.
Yeah, I get that because, like, I struggle with that too. And I think for me, it's like, it's just so out of our control. Like, there's nothing we can say. No matter how long we rant about it, we're not going to change any Bill O'Brien's decisions. We're not going to change how they play on the field. So it's just so out of control. So you're right, just like seeing sports in a way where it's entertaining and you can still cheer for your team and obviously still want them to win, but finding like the little things that you can enjoy, like finding like a guy like Jacob Martin that is like a nobody and is like, like finding that type of passion. It's like, that's what's going to like keep you in love with sports, I guess.
Yeah, that's a good point. And like, I guess like the only downside to it's like, well, you never get Bill O'Brien as the offensive coordinator and he's around the ball in first times with Carlos Hyde 15 times a game. That's not fun football and that's not enjoyable football. And so, you know, at the same time, like whenever you have that sort of conservative play calling, the team isn't as interesting as it could be and as entertaining as it should be as well, too. But I think like after this exercise, they have a really like better idea and understanding. Like I feel like I really understand Bill O'Brien's head coach now just by sitting here and going through like the good stuff he's done and knowing how much worse it could be. And I think I also am able to better appreciate and understand all the bad stuff too. And like for this entire season, like it's going to be kind of the big, I guess one of the big narratives in the league is if the Texans can take the next step and, you know, get past the first round and how all these decisions Bill O'Brien made this offseason, if they're going to pay off at all. This was good. What about you, Carlos? Do you have any other thoughts on this mental exercise we completed?
Honestly, I think this upcoming season, actually, I'm really excited considering all the tumultuous things that have happened this offseason. You know, I feel like it's almost like unwrapping a mystery box, right? You just don't know what you're going to get this season. It could be a high-flying, ridiculously fun offense. Or at the same time, it could be a total breakdown of the team. We have a crazy, you know, rough season, and we finally see the boot given to B.O.B. if things go wrong. But, you know, I think there's a lot of potential there, and it's going to be really interesting to see if the team puts it together. And, you know, I feel super excited to see what happens.
This exercise, it was fun. It was interesting. It was kind of like going through therapy and just kind of talking things out. And it was good to like put everything into perspective. Like you said, like if you're only thinking about one spectrum, then you kind of just get lost in your thoughts and you don't really have a good argument at all if you can't put things into perspective. So it was good to see. And yeah, I don't know how like you can't be excited about a season. Like I'll pretty much never be like not excited for a season. Sean Watson, I think with him, he's the main guy. Like, he's going to win us games. He's going to carry us. I strongly believe we're going to make the playoffs because of him. I think he's going to have an MVP level season, and he's going to make football fun. It's always fun with him. He makes crazy plays. He gets kicked in the eye. He throws blind touchdowns. Like, he's Houdini. He's a magician. So with him, I'll always have faith in Texans and be excited to watch them.
Yeah, and that's a great point too. Like with Watson, you know, anything's possible at all. Or all things through Watson, anything is possible. And like, I'm really interested just to see what's going to happen, this one possession record thing. Cause I do think if it flips and they're like, you know, 4-5 or in their one score records next year, like they may miss the playoffs, and it'd be interesting to see how much of an effect regression has next year, or if they have like a negative turnover differential. But I do think, you know, it's going to come down to, you know, Watson improving as a quarterback, the offense improving too, you know, having more hot routes and more reads for him, and allow him to get the ball out quicker and be more vertical. So the only viewer question we had here tonight, or listener question, was from @ReportTexans, and they asked, not as a play caller, but as a head coach, what improvements would you like to see out of O'Brien this coming year? And, you know, if we're not talking about him as a play caller and him as a head coach, I guess it's just kind of like getting more out of some of these other players that he has. Like, I don't think Cutie's going to stay on the field at all. But like, I really like to see Kahale Waring do more. I'd like to see some more stuff out of the young players this season. And also, I do hope with Tim Kelly being the offensive coordinator, you know, and O'Brien's not calling plays at all, that like he'll be more in tune with having a play ready to go on 4th-and-1, knowing that, hey, don't challenge this because you're going to waste a timeout and you're talking about 7 yards here, and 7 yards isn't worth the potential of losing a timeout. And it's dubious that it may flip it all to begin with as well, too. And so I do hope with Kelly as offensive coordinator, O'Brien has more of ability to do that. And also week-to-week game plan, too. And I know there's that podcast on Move the Sticks they had last year where Lanzee said, well, you know, O'Brien's not looking at the game plan until Thursday, making adjustments. They're not doing their walkthrough till like Saturday or whatever. And both Bucky Brooks and Daniel Jeremiah kind of lost their minds hearing that. It's like that's way too late at all, and it's hard to have like a cohesive game plan because of that. And so I do hope that O'Brien gets some more time, you know, game planning, focusing on the opponent and develop better game plans because he doesn't have to play call and do all that sort of stuff later in the week. And so not him as a play caller, but as him a head coach, those are two things I'd like to see out of him this upcoming year. Carlos, are there any things that you would like to see out of O'Brien, not as a play caller, but as a head coach?
Man, I was going to jump right into play calling.
Well, go ahead.
As a head
go
coach,
ahead, you need to.
As a head coach, I would definitely like to see him at least play a little nicer with the media. It seems like every press conference I see him, and he's just, you know, really like, oh, let me get this over with. And oftentimes he can be a little combative, too, depending on the question. And, you know, I just think it's part of the job to face everybody and go out and put on a smile and be diplomatic. So I think he could work to be a little bit better at that. But play calling wise, I definitely want to see, you know, now that we have this uptick in speed, it'd be nice to see some RPO, you know, kind of copy the Chiefs a little bit, use some of that speed to our advantage, give Deshaun some options on every play. You know, I can just almost see it if they do it right, being able to stretch the field, option out to Duke if they need to. And if anything, if the whole play breaks down, we've still got Deshaun that has the wheels to pick up yards. So, I guess those would be the two things.
I like that. What do you have, Jordan?
For me, so just to start off, something that people don't really take into mind, actually, like coaches improving. Like, we'd always talk about like players improving, but no, like, they can. I mean, one of the best examples for me is like Andy Reid. Like, Andy Reid was not a very good coach. Like, he was okay, but he's not like the coach that he is nowadays, where he's one of the best coaches in the league. And I don't think that's really up for debate. So like, coaches can improve too. And I think what I would look for, like we mentioned before, Bill O'Brien, he doesn't get the most out of his talent. And it'll go elevating the talent on the roster by kind of putting them in positions to succeed, putting them in positions to play their strengths. Like you said, like, we should not be seeing Angelo Blackson on third down trying to rush the passer. Like, just play him first, second down, stop the run, whatever, things like that. Like, I don't want to see Brendan Scarlett in coverage. I don't want you to be rotating Charlie Heck and Roger Johnson. Like, just play one person, let them get in rhythm. Like, things, little things like that, just playing players to their strengths and kind of maybe making more adjustments to his scheme rather than having people try and fit into, like Carlos said, like a square peg in a round hole. So those are two little things for me.
I like it. So that's our show for tonight. We'll probably have a show on later for this weekend for your Saturday walks or Sunday thunderstorms. And then next week here sometime soon, we'll do let's talk about some guys. And we'll every time I think we'll have nothing left to say or nothing left to talk about this team or football in general, you know, something always kind of pops up. So we'll keep the show going throughout the summer, and you know, hopefully we're able to start the show again, like for the 2020 season around time, and everybody stays healthy and this whole, you know, little bug goes away, as Kyle McNair puts it, and everything goes back to, you know, somewhat semblance of normal as well too. But anyways, thank you for listening to Battle Red Radio. Thank you for being on the show tonight, Carlos and Jordan. And again, I'm Matt Weston. Thank you for listening to Battle Red Radio.
That sounded good to me. I thought it was pretty good.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hi, this is Scott Galloway, professor of marketing at NYU Stern School of Business and host of the Prof G Pod. If you don't know me, the New York Times calls me the Howard Stern of business. Gary Swisher, super friggin' insightful, and Elon Musk, an insufferable numbskull. I think we're going to make up. I think we're going to go somewhere and do ketamine together. Each week on my show, the Prof G Pod, we bring you insights from blue flame thinkers, including my nemesis, Adam Grant. super smart guy. My nemesis because he's really good. Or one of our favorite journalists, Fareed Zakaria. Fareed's a total gangster. And not only that, we provide listeners with a markets-driven episode every Monday. We answer our listeners' questions about business, big tech, and career pivots every Wednesday and get to listen to the sweet sound of George Hahn reading our newsletter every Saturday. That's right. The Prop G Pod is in your feeds four times a week. I'm like AOL in the 90s. To resist is futile. Put your hand into a box of cereal. Is it a tasty, sugary snack? Nope. It's the duck.